The chairman has asked for that I introduce to you from Texas, Shotgun Mary.
Thank you. If any of you are curious about why I'm called Shotgun, it's because I earned it. And a man came up to speak before I got up here, and he said, "Are you Bloody Mary?" Also, some of you think I talk funny. It's because I do. I'm a born and bred Texan with his funny Texas twang. And before I begin talking, I want to tell you about my medallions I'm wearing tonight. This is my silver medallion that my sponsor, Willie B. of Spring, Texas, gave me on my 25th AA birthday 3 years ago. And Willie has been my sponsor for the last 10 years. Because one of my sponsors moved away, and one of my sponsors died. And even though I had been sober 18 years, I still felt I needed a backup sponsor. So I asked Willie, and that's one of the smartest moves I ever made. Now, this little bronze medallion, there's a little story attached to this. Did any of you ever see the movie The Best Little Whorehouse in Texas? Well, there's a story behind that, too. But there was a famous whorehouse at LaGrange, Texas, called the Chicken Ranch. And it had been in business for 150 years, and it did a thriving business. It was located halfway between the University of Texas and Texas A&M. And it was a money-making machine. And a TV reporter in Houston got crosswise with the sheriff and accused him of taking a bribe. And in all the publicity and hullabaloo that started over that, they had to close down the Chicken Ranch. And there was a lot of moaning and groaning when the Chicken Ranch closed down, too. But anyway, I have had my beads for several months and worn them several times. And I looked down once and I saw this medallion, and it had a chicken and a rooster engraved on it. And when I read what was on my medallion, this little gray-haired, prim woman nearly fainted. Now, I ain't prim, I just look prim. Because on one side of my medallion, it says, "The Chicken Ranch, LaGrange, Texas." And on the other side, it says, "Good for all night." My name is Mary, and I am an alcoholic. And I have been sober since April the 21st of 1964, one day at a time. And this miracle of sobriety, this amazing grace, is because of a divine and loving providence, my two beloved sponsors, Gloria P. and Lee H., and because of people exactly like you. Now, I grew up in a West Texas town called Breckenridge, and it's deep in the heart of Texas. And my mother and father were the social leaders of the church group in this town, and they entertained a lot. But being good Baptists, they didn't drink alcohol, and they didn't serve alcohol. But they worked for it, and they weren't against it. And my little friend's parents at the country club said, drank alcohol and served alcohol, and it was just all right. And I grew up in my formative years thinking alcohol was a beverage. And the good Lord knows it ain't no soda pop. It's a mood-altering chemical formula, and it was so toxic to me, it almost cost me my life. Now, I'm married, but lately I have been thinking about the marrying kinds in AA. You all know some. There's one man who's been sober a long time in Houston, has already been married 11 times. And I sponsor a woman that's been married 8 times, and she's divorcing the last one. And I heard about a man in West Virginia that said he had jars of peanut butter that lasted longer than some of his marriages. Well, I want to tell you that I don't know what I might have missed, because since the Stone Age, I have been married to the same husband one day at a time. I am the mother of two grown sons, and I thank God every day they're grown and raised, grown and reared, whatever. Someone told me you raise flowers, you rear children. And you taught me early, and when I was teachable, that I could not live my sons' lives. As a result of this, I let go of these sons, and they lived their lives and tended their business, and I lived my life and tended my business, and we have a pretty good relationship. Now, I am a grandmother, but I ain't the babysitting kind of grandmother. The idea of baking cookies and entertaining grandchildren is just not my bag. And I belong to an old and honorable profession. I am a housewife. Now, I am not a member of the oldest profession. And it's a damn good thing. Considering my mean personality and how ugly I looked, I would have starved to death. I took my first drink when I was a senior in high school, and it ended in complete disaster. I got sick. I got drunk. I threw up on everybody just like a flamethrower. Everybody was trying to get out of my way. And this was, oh, this was a disaster. And when I woke up the next morning with my first hangover, I prayed for 2 days that I could die. I don't ever want to forget that first hangover. But, you know, I had a thousand upon thousands after that. But, now I've lost my place. What was I talking about? Huh? Oh, yeah. And anyway, this was such a bad trip for me that I didn't drink anything for the next 10 years. And in that 10 years, I had married. I was the mother of these 2 small sons. And we were buying a new used home and a new used car all on 1 salary. And there wasn't enough money left out of the budget for me to have help with my housework. And I had an awful lot of housework to do, and I hated housework. And Irma Bombeck says, housework, if it's done right, can kill you. But I felt like this little hippie bride. She told her best friend, she said, oh, housework is such a drag. She said, you wash the dishes and make up the beds, and 3 weeks later, you have to do it all over again. One afternoon, I was trying to wade through a big ironing, and back in those days, you had to iron everything but the socks and the underwear. And a friend came by and suggested a cold beer. And I remember thinking, well, it's just a beverage. And you know, when I drank that beer that afternoon, my alcoholism kicked in, but I didn't know that's when it happened. But alcohol did something to me. First of all, it made me feel like $1 million. On 2 beers, I felt like $1 million. And I got through that big ironing, just lickety-split, and I thought, oh, boy, I have found the answer. And had I ever more. You know what happened? I started drinking 2 to 4 beers a day, keep my house clean, 4 to 6 beers a day, 6 to 8 beers a day. I had the cleanest house in Houston. I even put newspapers under the cuckoo clock. When I got up to 8 to 10 beers a day, that's when I thought I'd switch to bourbon. And within 2 years after drinking those 2 beers that afternoon, I was in serious trouble with my alcoholism, only I didn't know that's what it was. And this is when I started experiencing a personality change. Did any of you in this room ever have a personality change when you drank? Well, my personality change became so bizarre and so dangerous that my husband had to start taking the firing pins out of all the guns in the house. Because when they would accuse me or they would criticize me, and I don't take criticism well after 28 years. I sure didn't take it well back there. In my drunken rage, I would grab a gun and I would try to shoot whoever was criticizing me. That's where I got. I ain't called shotgun for nothing. You know. but I am described perfectly in the big book on page 21 in three sentences where it says the alcoholic does absurd, incredible, and tragic things while drinking. He is a regular Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. He is seldom mildly intoxicated. He is always more or less insanely drunk, and that describes me to a T. And they got where they'd hide the guns from me, but I could always find them. Then they got where they locked up all the ammunition from me out in the pump house out in the backyard. And they had me for a while. But one morning I got up, and I had committed an error the night before. I had drunk everything in the house up during a blackout, and I didn't have anything to get up on. And I had to get up, and don't ever tell me an alcoholic doesn't have willpower, because I used sheer willpower to get up, to get breakfast off, get my husband off to work, and these two sons off to school, and I think one was in kindergarten. And when they left, I was in the living room, I was watching the clock on the mantel, and when it got 9 o'clock, I was going to the liquor store, which took 15 minutes. Now, many a morning, I had gotten to the liquor store before it opened, and I would be waiting out there with those winos and those weirdos. And this was humiliating to me. You know, I was exactly like those winos. It was just a matter of degree. And I sure was acting weird. But I used iron willpower, and so I could walk in that liquor store like a lady and buy my 2 or 3 half pints of Old Crow. I tell you. And while I was waiting for the liquor store to open, I was remembering how mean they had been to me the night before. They had, all of them had tongues of vipers, and then they wouldn't let me shoot them. And a very sick thought came to mind. I thought, I know just what I'll do. I'll stop back by the hardware store and I'll buy my own ammunition. Which I did. And I didn't buy ordinary shells. I bought hollow points. Now, this is ammunition that is not designed to wound or to wound. It is designed to devastate. What it does, it enters an object and it just opens up and just tears a big hole as it goes through. And this loving wife and mother came home from the liquor store and the hardware store with 3 half pints of Old Crow and 10 or 12 boxes of devastating ammunition. Well, I started hiding these shells all over the house because I knew what they'd do to me when they found out I had them. And I'd hide 15 here and 15 there and upstairs and downstairs and under the stairs and in the drape and under the carpet. And you know, I've often wondered what those people thought that bought that house from us. And after I had outsmarted an alcoholic husband and 2 small sons, I felt real smug. And nothing uneventful happened for several months. Now, I didn't always lose control. I didn't always get dangerous. Sometimes I got drunk and loved everybody, and sometimes I got drunk and was industrious, and sometimes I got drunk and I just passed out. But I never knew what was going to happen to me when I drank. But one afternoon, my husband and these 2 boys were out in the backyard pitching horseshoes, and they were having the best time. And I was in there. My husband is a beer alcoholic, and the icebox was full of beer. And what I was doing, I was sipping on his beer, and then I'd go in my bedroom, and I'd take 2 or 3 slugs of Old Crow and come back and chase it with his beer. And I want to tell you tonight, I drank so much Old Crow before I got to AA that that is exactly what I looked like 28 years ago. I'm just glad I didn't drink Old Granddad. Or Wild Turkey. My husband came in to get a beer and he looked at me and he says, Mary, how in the hell can you be so drunk on 2 beers? I looked up at him so innocent, I said, I don't know. It must be my metabolism. I didn't know what that meant, but the important thing was he didn't know what it meant. So he took a beer and went outside. But when he asked me this, this old mean mood had been coming on real slow, and when he asked me that question, that just snapped. I thought, I'm going to shake them up a little bit. They're having too much fun out there. I didn't want anybody to have a good time if I was miserable. So I got my .22 automatic rifle, which I had won in a poker game one night when I was drunk. And I loaded it, and I wasn't going to shoot him. I was just going to shake him up a little bit. And I went out on the back porch, and I just fired into the ground two or three times. Bing, bing, bing. You never saw a covey of quail scatter the way my lungs did. They just, vroom. You know, one went east, and one went west, and one went over the cuckoo's nest. But one went behind a boat shed, and one went behind a great big oak tree. You could park a tank behind it, you couldn't see it. And the other went behind the side of the house, and they were catcalling back and forth. What in the world had happened? I had double-crossed them again. And they came to two conclusions. The first conclusion was that gun was loaded. And the second conclusion was, so was I. So it was after this little episode that they started taking the firing pins out of all the guns in the house. You know, one of the most insidious phases of this disease of alcoholism is we turn against those that we love and need the most. And I can well identify with any man in this room who has gotten drunk and abused his wife and children. But it was after this when I felt threatened, I would revert to the butcher knives and the meat cleavers and the ice picks. Lord, Lord, many a morning I have gotten up to fix breakfast for my family, and I'd open the drawer, knife drawer, and there wouldn't be a beer opener, an ice pick, or anything in that drawer with a point or an edge on it. And my heart would just sink. And I would make that long, slow walk down to my son's bedroom, never knowing what I was going to find. And I checked them out, and they had all their ears, and they were breathing. And oh, I would breathe such a sigh of relief. But when I have found these butcher knives and this great big old meat cleaver up under their pillows, I would know I had just been dreadful the night before. And I'd reach up under there to get a knife so I could go in and finish breakfast. And I walked back to my kitchen with the heaviest heart and the sickest soul of any woman you will ever know. And I put this knife in the sink so I could finish breakfast. And I had a window over my sink, and it faced out toward the east. And about this time the sun was rising, and I was so sick at heart and so desperate about what was the matter with me, and I'd look out that window and I would say, my God, I have done it again. What is the matter with me? I didn't know I had a disease called alcoholism that was causing this insane behavior. And this is when the suicide attempts came into play. My remorse and the guilt were just eating me alive. And one evening my husband came in, and I tried to commit suicide so much it got to be old hat around our house. One evening my husband came in from work, and he lifted the gun rack, and he says, Mary, where's my shotgun? I said, it's upstairs. He said, well, what's it doing upstairs? And I said, well, I planned to kill myself. He undid his tie and walked past me, and he said, what again? And once I jumped out of the car, it was going 80 miles an hour. And I jumped off in a ditch and just rolled end over end. And I just took the skin off of every joint of my body. I spent 8 days in the hospital after this little stunt. But you know, I knew the law of averages was going to catch up with me, and I was going to kill myself. Now, I didn't want to die. I just didn't want to live this sick way that I was living. And this is when I decided I would go to the doctor and let him check me over and find out if there was something wrong with me. I went to an internist. And this was the beginning of the prescription phase of my alcoholism. And before it was over, I took the whole drug spectrum. I took energizers, stabilizers, tranquilizers, barbiturates, and a lot of narcotics. I drank a lot of Paragard because it has opium in it. And the only reason, and it wasn't odd at all for the druggist to call me and say, Mrs. Moncrief, there is a new prescription on the market. And I thought perhaps it might help you. And I'd say, well, Mr. Blank, you just send it out. Now, I never smoked pot. I never snorted cocaine. And I never used heroin for three reasons only. That's the medical profession, the pharmaceutical companies, and the liquor industry. With these three organizations going for me, I didn't need anything else to get me through the day. Back in those days, the doctors interviewed you before they saw you. Now you fill out a long form, they look at it, and then they talk to you. But he was interviewing me, and I told him, I said, now, Yeah, I drink nearly every day, and nearly every day I get drunk. I might even be an alcoholic. He shook his head and smiled at me, and he said, nonsense. A nice little woman like you couldn't be an alcoholic. I agreed with him 100%. But he couldn't find anything wrong with me. I was in perfect health, and I was dying. But when my liver function test came back, he said, see, it was perfect. He said, see, you couldn't be an alcoholic. All alcoholics have liver damage. You know, that doctor misspoke, I think. I heard Ron Reagan say that once, the reason I picked up on it. And so he was alarmed, though, about my suicide attempts. And he put me on a weekly series of vitamin and hormone shots, and he put me on the amphetamine drug, which is the PET pill. And this amphetamine is medicine that is used for depression. It is also used in weight control. And what it does, it jazzes up your thyroid and gives you a lot of energy. It depresses the appetite centers in your brain, and you're not hungry. So you gin around all day and don't eat, ergo you lose weight. But if you abuse these amphetamines the way I did, you will also lose some of your marbles. So I came home from the doctor's office, weighing 90 pounds, dripping wet, and a great big bottle of reducing medicine. But within 30 minutes after I took that first PET pill, I thought I had been reborn. Oh, it was a glorious feeling. My depression left me. It was hallelujah. And I did 3 weeks work in one afternoon on one PET pill. And my husband came in from work that evening, and the boys met him at the back door and said, oh, Daddy, guess what? Mother feels good. And once again, I thought I had found the answer. Once again. This wonderful medication, though, had a bad drawback to it. I was so exhilarated and happy, I couldn't sleep. So I called the doctor to tell him that I wasn't doing well, I wasn't sleeping. And the first thing he said was, we sure do want you to sleep. So he sent me my first prescription for the sleeping tablet. So I get up in the morning, I take the PET pill, and I take the sleeping tablet at night. And I stayed all right for maybe a couple of months on that, I don't really know. And the icebox is full of beer, and I'm still alcoholic, and I reach in there, and I start drinking, and I start losing control, and I start getting scared, and I call the doctor about this. And he's of the opinion that the amphetamine needed, the speed run of the amphetamine needed to be slowed down. And it seems there was a brand new drug on the market called a tranquilizer. And he sent me a prescription, and it had the magic words on there, take as needed. So I was getting up in the morning, and I was taking my PET pill, my tranquilizer through the day, the sleeping tablet at night, and of course, you know, I was tripping, quadrupling, every one of those. I was still going every week to the doctor to get my vitamin hormone shot. And when I started to... then the icebox is still full of beer. And I, as an alcoholic, it is as normal for me to drink as it is for me to breathe. So I reach in there and I start drinking again. And when I start drinking this time, taking all that medicine, it was taking a dreadful toll of everything about me. My naturally curly hair became limp and stringy. I've always been just a little bit cross-eyed. And back in those days, I had to go around with one eye closed. And I had a green cast to my complexion with undertones of yellow. And I had lost 5 pounds on my reducing medicine. Now, if this wasn't bad enough, skinny, cross-eyed, and green. I was growing hair on each side of my face. And a very prominent mustache across my, on my chin and face and across my mouth. Now, I don't know how long I had looked this way. But if I'd been growing horns and a tail, my family would not have said a word to me. They wouldn't do anything to upset Mother. But one day I had to go someplace, and I had to fix my face. So this is when I discovered that if you have a beard, you can't powder your face. And I remember looking through that haze of powder, and I saw myself, and I nearly fainted. I thought, surely to God, I'm not supposed to be growing a mustache. And I took myself out the doctor's office as fast as I could go. And while I was waiting, back in those days, you just went to see him. You didn't have to make appointments. And while I was waiting for him to come in to see this phenomenon, I got a little philosophical about it. I thought, well, if I have to, I guess I can start shaving every day. Horrible thought. And he came in and looked at me and turned my head from side to side, and he said, honey, I'm not worried about that on your face. It's caused from the hormone shots. He said, I want to know if you're growing any hair on your chest. Now, this is the most insulting thing anybody ever asked me in my whole life. I started unbuttoning my buttons, and when I got to my blouse, and when I got to this button, it hit me, the full import of what he had actually told me hit me, and I was blazing mad, and I said, I don't know, you son of a bitch, but I better not be. You never saw a monkey looking for fleas. Well, I was trying to find one hair on my, but I was spared that indignity. But you can bet all your blue chip stocks and your gold edge bonds I quit taking those hormone shots, right? And that's the same equivalent as if you fellas, you guys, were going to a doctor that you trusted for treatment over a period of several months, and lo and behold, one day you started experiencing a 28-day female cycle. You can bet your last quarter that you would be upset. Now, I want to tell you guys, don't give up your primary hormone shots, because what he was doing to me shouldn't have been done to a dog. But on the way home from the doctor's office, I swore up and down, up one side and down the other, never was going to take another drink. Sure wasn't going to take any of those hormone shots. And within 30 minutes after I got home, I was drinking again, and I didn't know what happened to me. It was along about this time they were printing a lot of articles in the leading magazines and all the newspapers about Alcoholics Anonymous and about alcoholism. Oh, I read all, I wasn't an alcoholic, but I read all of these articles avidly. I just read them over and over and over. And I decided that I would go to the library and I would research this alcoholism. In case I ever got it, I'd know what it was. God help me. And in the library, they had two books on the disease of alcoholism. And one was a book written by a man entitled Drinking Is Not the Problem. And the other was the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know which one I read first. This man had been living with a nagging woman for 11 years, and he drank every day, got drunk. And as soon as he quit her, he didn't drink anymore, and he hadn't had a drink in over 2 years. And I read that, and I thought about that, and I thought, well, of course. This is all my husband's fault. I'll divorce him, and I'll get all right. But right along behind that came another little thought. Oh, if I quit Lenore. And I knew by that time I was totally unemployable. But in reading the big books, they said that they considered alcoholism a three-way disease. It was physical, it was mental, and it was spiritual. And I thought, Lord, I was raised in the church, and I haven't been to church in years. I'll go back to church, and I'll be all right. I went back to church, and I still got drunk. I thought, well, I'm going to the wrong church. I went to another denomination, and I still got drunk. And the big churches in Houston have counselors to talk to people who are troubled, and I was troubled. And these were rewarding experiences when those ministers would counsel with me, but, you know, this was so silly. That was like the halt leading the blind. They didn't know a damn thing about alcoholism, and I didn't either. But they would hold my hand and say a prayer over me, and I'd start home, and I'd feel pretty good about everything. I passed the liquor store, and my old car turned on in that liquor store, and there I was off and running again, and I didn't know what I was going to do. And the only time that my husband was out of town on a weekend, it was a cold February, and it was raining, and the boys were in the front of the house entertaining themselves, and I was in the back getting drunk. And we had an agreement that they would leave me alone if I would leave them alone. And I came to about 6 o'clock in the evening, and, oh, I was so full of guilt and remorse. And I thought, I'll fix those boys something good to eat. And I went in the kitchen, and I took an egg out of the icebox, and I dropped it on the floor, kerplunk. I reached in the icebox, and I got another egg, and I dropped it on the floor. And I looked down at those two eggs splattered all over the floor and between my toes, incidentally. And I thought, you know, I'm too drunk to cook. I'll go to the drive-in. I wasn't too drunk to drive. And on the way back from the drive-in, I missed my driveway and got stuck in the ditch in front of my house. And it was wet and raining, and I started having a wall-eyed fit trying to get out of that ditch. You know how it is. It just went in deeper and deeper. But when I started having a fit, the boys ran next door to the neighbors. And we lived on a dead-end street, and there were four other families on this street. And our children played together, and none of these women could drive, so I took all the kids to school, and I picked them up, drunk or sober. And I liked these women pretty good when I was sober. But when I was drunk, I just despised them. And you know whose fault it was. My car was out there in the ditch. It was all their fault. And I got out of my car in a loud screaming voice, and I cursed these women. I called them everything I could think of in the books to call somebody. And when I was drunk and in a rage, I had the vocabulary of a mule skinner. And then came the dawn. The front door was wide open, the back door was wide open. It had rained in some, and it was cold. I went to close the back door, and I saw the eggs on the floor, and I thought, oh, Lord, I remembered the eggs. When I went to close the front door and saw my car out in the ditch, I thought, oh, my God, I remembered the car. I also remembered what I had done. I also knew what I had to do. I had to go around the next day and apologize. And the next day, these women, they were women, you know. They weren't all those names I called them. And I went to each one of them, and I told them that I was ashamed of myself. I had been drunk the night before, and I asked him to forgive me. And now, this was the first time my drinking had gone outside the confines of my home and my backyard in a number of years. Because my husband's job, we had to go out a lot socially to cocktail parties and celebrate and receptions and things like that. And more often than not, I would start a scene with somebody. My husband said I had an unerring instinct to pick a scene with the biggest man in the room. And he'd have to rescue me, and, you know. So he brought me home one night, and he said, Mary, I will never take you out in public again because you are going to get me killed. And you know, he didn't take me out till I'd been sober almost 3 years. He didn't trust me till I'd been sober that long. And, several of the doctors that I had gone to, I made the round of the doctors, by the way, and a couple of them had suggested that perhaps a psychiatrist might help me. But I wasn't willing to go to a psychiatrist till this little incident. And I called on Monday, and I had an appointment on Tuesday morning, bright and early, to see the psychiatrist. And I worried all night, should I tell him the truth or should I lie to him? I wanted help so bad. I was trying to make up much big lies. But I decided that I'd just lay it straight for him. I lay it out on the table, and I told him everything I could think of to tell him about me. I told him about my sexual fantasies. I told him about everything. My erotic dreams, I didn't leave a stone unturned. And he made a decision to put me in Herman Hospital to take a series of insulin shock treatments, and I was every bit of 32 years old. And he wanted me to take 60 insulin shock treatments, but we couldn't afford but 30. And we had to borrow money to do that from my mother. And but every day, and incidentally, those shock treatments are brutal things. I hated that. Oh, I hated those shock treatments. They gave them to me early every morning. But I thought, if this is the price I have to pay to get well, I'll pay any price. And every morning, the psychiatrist would come in and talk to me.
We just got to be real good buddies. I'd been in the hospital about 3 weeks, and he said, Mary, you don't have anything to worry about. You are not an alcoholic. Now, I wasn't happy with this diagnosis, but because of this diagnosis, I drank a long, long time. I had many, many years of drinking disease because of this diagnosis. I might have drunk anyway. I don't know. And when I got out of the hospital, though, I gained 20 pounds, and I just felt wonderful. But within six weeks, I was back on the same old 6 and 7. Thank you, love. I was back on the same old 6 and 7, getting drunk. And there I was. So this is when I made the round of other doctors. I went to a chiropractor. I went to a psychologist. I went to a faith healer. I went to the Mental Health Association people. I went to a hypnotist. I would have embraced any creed or any cult to have gotten well of whatever this was that was killing me. And I didn't know what I was going to do. But one of the psychologists working with my medical doctor, what was that? Ooh, suggested that I take they put me on the drug antabuse. This is medication that if it's in your bloodstream and you drink, it will make you violently ill and it could cause your death. So the last 6 years of my drinking, I stayed sober on antabuse 2 days to 6 weeks, and I went back to drinking, and I drank 2 days to 6 weeks, and it was a hell of a way to live. Well, it was in 1962, I guess. I had to go to Wichita Falls to a wedding, Wichita Falls, Texas, by the way, to a wedding, and I was on antabuse when I got up there. And at the reception after the wedding, I was visiting with an aunt from another town. You know, at funerals and weddings, you see people you don't ordinarily see. And I turned to walk away from Aunt Cindy, and she called out to me. She says, Mary, by the way, said, your cousin Gloria is moving to Houston. Said, she is in AA now, and she's just doing beautiful. But when Aunt Sydney called these words out to me, a hush fell over that room. Everything got so still, you could have heard a pin drop. And in that moment of hush, something way deep inside of me said, I am going to be saved. That somehow, through Gloria and AA, I was going to be made whole again. And you would have thought, after I'd been going up all these blind alleys, that I'd come back, get in touch with Gloria and get in AA and everything just be hunky-dory. But it didn't work out that way. I had some more drinking to do. And incidentally, Gloria was a complete and utter stranger to me. I'd never laid eyes on her in my life. But I did finally, in a weak moment, call Gloria. And she said, well, Mary, she hadn't talked to me over 2 minutes, and she said, well, Mary, you are an alcoholic. You know, I knew she was right. And a weight fell off of my shoulders. This was the first honest-to-God diagnosis that I had ever had in all of these years I had been trying to find an answer. And I still had some more drinking to do. And I'd say, well, Glory, I'm not drinking. I'm taking antabuse. And she'd say, well, honey, ordinary social drinkers don't have to take antabuse to not drink. She would just devastate me. She talked to me for 13 months before I went to my first AA meeting. And in that 13 months, she would scare the liver out of me. She would say that alcoholism is progressive, it is incurable, and it terminates fatally. That was worth a drunk right there. And she would say, as an alcoholic, I had 3 choices. I could get locked up in an insane asylum or jail, I could get covered up in the grave, or I could get sobered up. So, you know that old saying, locked up, covered up, or sobered up. Those were terrible choices. And I'd say, Gloria, I've never been in jail. I've never been involved in an automobile accident. I've never been in a mental institution. And she'd say, well, honey, you just keep drinking, and these things will happen to you. And I knew she was right. In 1963, our youngest son went away to school. And this was the first time in all my years of drinking that I didn't have somebody coming in and looking over my shoulder and monitoring me. And I nearly drank myself to death. I drank solid for 3 weeks. And this is when I tried to commit suicide in a blackout. And this just scared me to death. I took the attitude, if I was going to kill myself, I wanted to know about it. I didn't want to wake up somewhere strange dead that I didn't know was back. And this scared me so bad, I got on the phone and I said, Gloria, I need help. And she said, yes, honey, I know you do. We have been fooling around about this long enough. So that was the night that Gloria and Lee came out and made a 12-step call on me. My husband got up to greet them. He didn't want, Lee came out to sponsor my husband, but my husband didn't want to sponsor. He had some more drinking to do. And anyway, while I was waiting for Gloria and Lee to get there, I was remembering I had a terrible bad habit on some of my drugs that I wouldn't bathe, I wouldn't comb my hair, I wouldn't brush my teeth. I was just a regular slob. That's why I just love to get all foo-fooed up in AA. I just love it. I was remembering that my husband is such a fastidious alcoholic. He takes showers during blackouts. And this bothered him no end that I didn't take a bath every day, you know, on my drugs. He did. So one afternoon we were both about half drunk and he made a bad mistake. He decided he was going to give me a bath. He was going to give me a shower. When he took me in the bathroom and locked the door, I didn't know he was going to give me a shower. When he started undressing me, I sure didn't know he was going to give me a shower. As soon as he got me completely undressed, he shoved me in that shower and turned on the water. And you talk about a letdown. Oh, I tell you, I'd come out of that shower and he'd push me back in. And finally he got so mad and disgusted, he got in the shower with me, clothes and all. And he was standing behind me and he was holding me like this and he was trying to put soap on me and I was kicked out all three sides of that shower. It was just, I just demolished that shower. And the next day when he was trying to rebuild it, he looked so pitiful, he just said, I'll never try to give you another bath. 2 or 3 weeks later, the boys were out on the back porch and they were bored. All the kids in the neighborhood had something to do with them and they were grumbling. One of them said, I wish something interesting would happen around here. The other one brightened up and said, say, maybe Daddy will try to give Mama another bath. But when I opened the door that night to Gloria and Lee, they were the most beautiful sight I had ever seen in my life. First of all, they were clean, they were sober, they were well-groomed, and they were happy. And whatever it was they had, I wanted it. And we were visiting that night, and Lee caught my attention, and he said, Mary, if you could be given one wish tonight above all others, what would you ask for? And without a moment's hesitation, I said, I want peace of mind. He said, you want serenity? And I said, oh, yes. You know, we are told in the promises that we will comprehend the word serenity and we will know peace. And this has been given to me in my years of sobriety in AA. And I am so grateful. And I started in AA. And I stayed sober 90 days. And I got drunk. And I started back in AA. I stayed sober 108 days. And I got drunk again. Only this was my last drunk, but I didn't know it, but I knew it was different from anything that I had been through. And each time I got drunk, I didn't drink for 2 days. And on this last drunk, my husband had to work on, Tuesday was a holiday, and we got drunk Monday and Tuesday, and he had to work Wednesday. Well, I was going to paper off on Tuesday and then go back to Travis on Wednesday. That was one of my regular meeting nights. And boy, when I got up that Wednesday morning, I don't ever want to go through the suffering that I went through. Oh, that's the most horrible day of my whole entire life. I was suffering. I needed a drink so bad. And I tell myself, all I have to do is go to the store and get 2 beers and this nightmare will be over. But I also knew if I drank that day, I would never sober up again the longest day I lived. And Glory would stay in touch with me all day long. She'd call me and she'd say, now don't. My husband had to teach school that night too, by the way. He taught blueprint reading at the apprentice schools. And she'd say, hang in there, honey. Don't drink. Hang in there. Don't drink all day long. She finally came in that evening. about 5 o'clock, and she said, "Mary, you have to get to a meeting tonight." And I said, "Glory, I'm not able to get in my car and drive to a meeting." She couldn't find it. She doesn't drive. She couldn't find anybody to come get me. So she got back on the phone about 6, and she said, "Now, Mary, this is what you're going to do, and don't say a word. You have to get to a meeting tonight, and you're going in your bedroom, and you're going to ask God to give you the strength to get to an AA meeting." And she added one more sentence. She said, "And he will give you this strength." And I went in my bedroom, and I got down on my knees, and all I said was, "Dear God, give me the strength to get to an AA meeting tonight." And I didn't know it at the time that I was knelt in the first sincere prayer of my entire life, that that was the moment that God started healing this fractured woman. Because from the time I rose to my knees, I had never had a compulsion to drink. It was taken away from me that night. I am done. Anyway, I got to a meeting that night, and that was it. When I got down to Travis, though, I started in the door, and I balked when I got to the door. And I never would have walked in that door if Gloria hadn't been by my side. You know, when anybody gets drunk in AA, everybody in the area knows about it. It's just like the beat of the tom-tom drums out in the jungle. And I didn't want to face you people. But Gloria took my hand, and she said, "Honey, this isn't the end. It is just the beginning." And we walked in the door, and it was truly the beginning. After I had a little sobriety, 2 or 3 days of sobriety in me, I realized I had a lot of bad things wrong with me. One of the worst traits I had was I wasn't able to give love to anybody. I couldn't love anybody. I couldn't love you. I hated myself. And it was just terrible. I was so empty inside. And I felt so bad about it. And I talked to Gloria and Lee, and they would tell me it'd be all right. Just hang in there, you know, go to meetings, read the big book. And I came across Gloria gave me a great big stack of grapevines. And it must have been in one of the grapevines, because incidentally, this man that I got this message from was from California. And he had borrowed a prayer from someone, and I borrowed it from him. And every night when I would go to bed, I would say, "Dear God, give me a small love to give, a small understanding, and a small love of which I might be worthy." And I don't have to tell you, this prayer has been answered 1,000 times over. I didn't know who this God was that was keeping me sober 24 hours at a time. I had no concept. The God of my childhood was not the God I wanted in AA. I didn't even have a God, but I wanted one. I was looking for one. I was praying for one, and nothing was happening. And I'd call Gloria up and say, "Gloria, I've been trying to find God. Now, where the hell is he?" She said, "Just keep doing that, you know, just keep going." And I came across something in some of the literature in my house. I don't know where it is. I wish I did. And at the bottom of the page, limned in black, and it was written by an old 17th century philosopher, and all it said was, "Fret not thyself. If you had not found me, you would not seek me." And I thought, now, I've been looking for God a long time. You suppose that's true? "Fret not thyself, if you had not found me, you would not seek me." And this had great meaning for me the second time I read it, and I thought, you know, if this old guy is right, and I think he is, I have already found God, or God has found me, it doesn't matter which, but this was a slow, slow spiritual growth in this woman that is continuing today. And just living one day at a time, I didn't know how to do that. And I read something Carl Sandburg wrote. He wrote, "Life is like an onion. You peel it back one layer at a time, and some days you weep." Well, I could kind of identify with that, and that's how I slowly learned to live one day at a time. Now, I don't always do it. I still travel ahead of time, worry and fret and stew and everything, but I try. But I have made a mistake back there in the Stone Age when I married my husband. I didn't know that he had a mother like he had. You girls always examine your mother, future mother-in-law, please. Oh, I'll tell you, she was neurotic, she was possessive, and she hated me with a passion. I could do nothing right. Didn't make any difference. Nothing I did was right. And I put up with that for 40 years. So I'd gripe about my mother. Now, here I was sober, doing pretty good. Wake up in the morning, the sun was shining, the birds were singing. I'd think of something that a woman had said to me 10 years before. just blow my whole day, you know. And finally, Gloria had enough. She says, Mary, if you don't quit hating that old woman, you are going to get drunk. And that is the first and only time she had ever threatened me like that. And it scared me. And I said, now, just how am I going to do that? She said, well, you're not going to like it. But I said, tell me. She said, well, you're going to pray for this old woman. I said, the hell I will. She said, she added one more sentence. She said, now, you're not going to pray for this old woman for her sake. You're going to pray for this old woman for your sake. And when she put it to me like that, I sure didn't want to get drunk. And I went in my bedroom and I stood in the doorway trying to find some option that I wouldn't have to do this. But finally, I have a special place by my bed that I say my prayers, and it's holy to me. It's sacred. When I got ready to pray for this old woman, I got clear around the side of the bed, the foot, and way up in the back corner, just as far as I could get. I didn't want to contaminate my good praying place. And I got down on my knees, and I said, now, dear God, you know I don't mean a word I say, but you bless Ethel. And I got toward the end of my prayers, I said, bless Ethel, bless Ethel. And I don't know, months later, I woke up one day, and I knew something was different, and I finally figured it out. That was the day I no longer hated that old woman. This hatred and resentment had been taken away from me. Now, she didn't change one damn bit. But she didn't have to change. I am the one that had to change. Now, 28 days after I took my last drink, my husband came into AA for his sake, and he's been sober 28 years last May the 19th. And the people would come up to us after we both came in AA, and they'd say, oh, Mary, it must just be wonderful. You and Lenar are both in AA. Why, you can just have your own AA meeting. I wanted to punch them out. We couldn't even agree on the preamble. And that's the truth. Incidentally, my husband is a fishing addict. He had rather fish than do anything. And we'd been sober about 5 years, and he was on a vacation, and we'd been fishing for 3 days. And he had beat the socks off me for 3 days. He asked me, said, are you going fishing with me tomorrow? And I said, not me. I'm trying something better to do. And I opened the gate for him to pull the boat out the next morning. And he said, are you sure you don't want to go fishing with me? I said, yeah, wait just a minute. Let me go get my fishing hat. And I rushed in there to get my fishing hat, and I knelt down real fast by the side of the bed. And I said, now, dear God, protect my house from tigers and let me beat Lenar catching fish. Well, we were out there, and I was catching fish. I had him beat. We hadn't been fishing very long. I said, Lenar, let's go. And he wasn't about to go. He said, nope. And he kept on, and I was still catching some, but he was about to catch up with him. And I said, Lenar, let's go. He said, no, I've at least got to get even with you. And I said, you just forget about that, boy. You can't do it this time. He looked at me and he said, Mary, what are you talking about? I said, well, when I said my prayers this morning, I asked God to let me beat you catching fish. He took his hat off and threw it in the boat, and he says, now, Mary, by God, that is dirty poo. I tell you. But in my sobriety, I have been given such a good life. I just couldn't ask for a better life than has been given to me. And I love my AA life, and I love being one of you, and I love being here tonight. And I started getting active in AA, and I have done everything that's to be done in AA just about. I've held every office, and I sponsor a lot of women, and I start a lot of meetings and get it started, and then I go on someplace else. But I have been active in AA because I was afraid if I didn't give my sobriety away, I might not keep it. And I have such a good time sponsoring these young women. They keep me young. And we just have a good time with them staying sober and having lunch when we can and going to meetings. And incidentally, I'm going to have to close up. Anyway, when I was drinking, I cared absolutely nothing for anything in the material sense, for clothes, furniture, crystal, none of that stuff meant anything to me. And I hate the shop. My husband doesn't know what a little treasure he has in me, does he? And I got a call from a friend in Wichita Falls, and she wanted to come to Houston and shop for crystal and china. And I said, sure, Virginia, come on down, but I have been real sick. It took me over 2 years to recuperate just a little bit the damage I had done to myself. And when Virginia and I went in and told my husband, I said, isn't that the silliest thing you ever heard of, drive 500 miles to buy crystal in China? But she came down and I took her to this brand new department store with a beautiful, whatever she wanted, crystal in China department. And I said, now Virginia, you just shop to your heart's content, and I'm going in there in the lounge chair in the furniture department and I'll wait for you. And as I started to leave Virginia, way at the back of the room, I saw a picture on the wall. And that was the most beautiful picture I've ever seen in my life. And I was drawn to this picture just like a magnet. And when I got up to it, it was a picture of roses, magenta-colored roses. And, oh, I wanted that picture. And it was $139. And, Lord, we couldn't afford $139 back in those days. But, you know, it wasn't important that I couldn't afford to buy that picture. The important thing was I could want something again. And you have a lot of bad days in AA. I had some. And most of them I brought on myself, by the way. But when I'd have a bad day, I'd think about my picture, and my heart would start smiling. It helped me get over the bad mood I was in. And one day I had to go into the department store to do something. And when I walked in the door, there was a mannequin there with a black and white checked taffeta raincoat on it. And I looked at that and I thought, I want that raincoat. And I looked at the price tag and it was $9.95. I could afford $9.95. So I bought into the size 10. I think I wore a 6, but they didn't make 6s that one, okay. So, but it had a lining in it and I could hem it up. So when I got through taking the last stitch around the bottom of it and around the sleeves and everything, I looked out the window. I wanted to start raining right then. I didn't think it was ever going to rain. You never saw an old drought farmer scan the skies for rain the way I was looking for it to rain. But lo, you know, into each life some rain must fall. One day I heard the pitter-patter of rain, and I thought, oh boy, I'm going to Travis tonight and I'm going to wear my new raincoat. And my garage is attached to my house. So I got my new raincoat on, and I got in the car, drove to Travis about 20 miles, and I sang every step of the way. I was just humming up a storm, singing with the radio, and this was the first time that I wanted to go to AA. Heretofore, I had been going to therapy. When I got down to the Travis Club, I turned off the radio, and I opened the door, and Lord, it was just a deluge of rain. I've never seen such rain in my life. And I got back in and closed the door, and I started laughing to myself, and I knew I was going to get well, because I had been waiting 3 weeks to wear my new raincoat, and I didn't want to get it wet. I'm going to have to close this down, and we're getting running a little late, but I want to thank you for being here tonight and all your laughter with me, because I love to laugh. And it's just been my pleasure to be here tonight. And I want to tell you, I have a lot of nicknames. I'm called Hip Shot. I'm called Fast Draw. I'm called Pistol Pete. I'm called Shotgun Mary. But I'm going to close tonight by telling you that because of the grace of God and Alcoholics Anonymous, this pistol-packing mama has laid her pistols down. Thank you very much.